Good morning. We'll call the meeting to order of the Agriculture Policy Committee here in the Minnesota House. Good morning, everybody. Should be a good meeting this morning. Got a lot of information. Having an update coming also from Farm Credit, the Ag Department Safety Account, and also a presentation from Land O'Lakes on some really exciting software they're working on in terms of where the best place to put conservation practices on our soil. So looking forward to that as well. First up, we have the Minnesota Ag Credit Update. Good morning, and good to have you here again today with us this morning. And identify yourselves, and please begin with your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Jessica Feary with Ag Country.
Can you speak closer to the mic? It's at least hard for me to hear you anyway.
Jessica Feary with Ag Country Farm Credit Services.
And Stacy Martin with AgStar Financial Services.
Mark Nisley, CEO of United FCS.
Well, Stacy, are you going first?
I can, absolutely. Okay. Thanks for having us this morning. And so there's three associations and farm credit associations in Minnesota, and we'll talk a little bit more about who we each are and who we represent. But we're pleased to be here today to share a little bit about farm credit and the clients that we work with and how we serve agriculture and rural communities throughout the state. Just some background for you. The farm credit system was established over 100 years ago, and Jessica will talk more about some of the details of what the farm credit system is, but we were essentially created to provide a reliable and consistent source of credit and financial services to rural communities and agriculture. As I mentioned, we're 100 years of history, but it's not looking back, rather looking to today and tomorrow. And so we're here to provide that adequate and constructive credit as is listed up there. But also, we're a farmer-owned cooperative. So that makes us unique as well. So there were our crafters 100 years ago looked at this unique opportunity to serve a very specific source of credit for agriculture and rural communities and do it in a way that was owned by our members themselves, which we'll also talk about further.
So as Stacy mentioned, we are part of the farm credit system, and we are the system is coming off of its centennial celebration, so 100 years of serving agriculture across the nation. And the entire farm credit system is really made up of a number of a nationwide network of borrower-owned cooperative financial institutions. And it's dedicated, and its mission really is to serve our farmers and ranchers and our rural communities across America. And we have a pretty, a limited base of customers that we are actually able to work with in terms of they have to be farmers and ranchers or farm-related service business and certain processing and marketing operations that are offshoots of those of the borrower's operations. And so we are limited in focus, and we really want to make sure that what we're doing is serving that mission of providing credit and financial services to those farmers and ranchers and then to the rural communities. We are regulated by the Farm Credit Administration, and oversight of the system and the FCA is provided by the Senate Ag Committee and the House Ag Committee.
And just a little bit more about Minnesota and to help you understand how we're divided up. As part of our creation as well, we were created to have defined territories. So you can see those on the map, either on the screen or on the handout that you have. So the three associations you have in front of you right now have defined territories. Ag Country leads over into North Dakota. United and AgStar, we both have territory that goes into Wisconsin as well. But we work primarily within those defined territories. We work collaboratively both with clients. We often get asked, what about a client that lives kind of in both? And we work together on those situations where we do have clients that have maybe counties that are in both territories. But not only working collaboratively with our clients and serving agriculture and rural communities, but we also work collaboratively here at the state capitol and on the federal level. And we've had a presence here at the state capitol since the early 80s in working together, and that's why we're here today to not only talk to you all, but to share the farm credit story throughout the the state capitol here today. We have to cover a wide range of commodities. When you look at the state of Minnesota, it's no secret to all of you that when you go from one quarter to the other, we do in Minnesota have a very diverse agriculture. And our portfolios of these three associations also represent that diverse portfolio. We have everything from sugar beets to canola to the traditional corn and soybeans, as you would think, to dairy, poultry, and other livestock, and that's just to name a few. So we get to touch a lot of areas of agriculture, and Jessica will share a little bit more about our individual associations.
So as Stacy mentioned, the farm credit system, the three associations serve the entire state of Minnesota. And within Minnesota, we provide $6.9 billion in credit to over 24,000 customers and farmers and members of our rural communities. We are also, we'd mentioned a little bit earlier that we're a cooperative, and so that we're farmer-owned and we're farmer-governed, and so our board of directors are made up of our farmer customers that are elected by our voting stockholders. And one of the unique things about being a cooperative is that we give our earnings back to our owners. And so across the three associations that serve Minnesota, last year the boards declared $62 million in patronage refunds that were paid out to the patrons across Minnesota, North Dakota, and Wisconsin. And that's something that the boards look at every year in terms of what are their earnings and what amount of earnings can we give back to our owners. And that money goes back to the farmers and ranchers and back into the rural communities that we're serving. We also are a large employer in the state of Minnesota, and we've got across the three associations over 750 employees that are housed in 31 branches across the state, and those branches are, you know, scattered all over in a lot of the small towns in Minnesota.
So we're going to switch things up and take the state hat off for a minute here, and we were asked to talk a little bit about what we're watching on the federal level. And so I'll cover a few of the things, and I note the word watch on here. That doesn't mean that we're actively taking positions on each of these things, but these are areas that we're watching both from an organizational standpoint, but more importantly from a client standpoint over the coming months. And as we talk through these, you'll see that they're areas that probably you all are either watching yourselves or will be on your radar in the near future, especially if there's legislation passed in each of these areas, because there are implications for the state. And there are opportunities for potential conformity as well. So the Affordable Care Act, you all have had health care as the top priority for you here, and it's no doubt a top priority to look at on the federal level. A lot of these items remain to be seen on how they're all going to play out, but it is one that we've consistently heard from our clients should be a top priority of what we're paying attention to and keeping on top of. You all have had those healthcare discussions. I know many of you in this room, we've either had discussions with you or we know that clients that have as well about the implications of healthcare and the opportunities and access to healthcare and the importance of that. On the tax reform front, both the Senate and House leadership have committed to trying to get tax reform passed by August. It's an aggressive goal, but definitely something on the federal level that there is an attempt to do. We're hearing rumblings about what that tax reform legislation will look like, but leadership is keeping it close to the belt, if you will, and so at this point we're waiting to see how that all rolls out. But there are positive opportunities for positive and potential negative implications for our clients in particular when we look at tax reform. It's also something that I know if there is tax reform passed, we'll be back talking about it next year with all of you to look at opportunities for conformity and how that can benefit agriculture and rural communities. Infrastructure legislation is another area. This is not just roads and bridges and waterways like we traditionally think of when we talk about infrastructure, but there's a coalition of rural interests in Washington, D.C. right now that are basically coming together to say, yes, we need roads, bridges, and waterways, and we need that infrastructure, but we also need broadband and access to broadband across rural communities. We need access to the healthcare infrastructure. So it couples with the Affordable Care Act, but really looking at access to health care and building an infrastructure so our rural communities can be connected and get the help, meet the health care needs of our citizens in those rural communities. Immigration reform as well is one that is on our radar. That one's going to be a complicated matter and always is, as it is on the state level as well, but one that we're watching. Trade has some significant implications. It's interesting. We did the same presentation for some of your counterparts in the Senate a few weeks ago, and there's been some significant changes on trade even since the last time I talked about it here at the on the Capitol grounds. Trade is one that we want to be at the table for. It's important for agriculture. It's important for our clients to have access to markets and the ability to either export or have relationships with those countries that will find value and need our products. And so actively being involved in, and if nothing else, reminding about the importance of trade for agriculture, but being involved in those discussions to the best of our ability. And then the federal farm bill is up for reauthorization this year. So that's something that we'll be, as a farm credit system, actively involved in as well, because there are a number of touch points for our clients within that federal farm bill. It needs to be reauthorized by next fall, and so that'll be happening on the federal level. So just a snapshot of some of the things we're watching on the federal level that do have interactions with the state level.
Just to pause for a second, we have a quorum here, so Representative Johnson has checked the minutes over, and would you move to approve the minutes?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I move to approve the minutes from February 1st.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes approved. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Just a quick question. You mentioned health insurance, and this may be more a question for Mr. Knisley. We would pass state legislation that would allow cooperatives to get into the business of health insurance. Have you had any discussions about where you may fit into talks about those types of things?
Mr. Chair, thank you. We were actively involved, the Farm Credit System was, a number of years ago, working with Cooperative Network and trying to establish health care cooperatives for farmers. So I could see a role in, from a farm credit perspective, possibly of being involved directly and or supporting a co-op made up of farmers and rural Minnesotans.
And Mr. Chair, just to add to that, as with everything, there's different nuances to depending on how a cooperative is established on the role we can or can't play. So obviously actively being involved to the best of our ability. And Mr. Knisley is going to talk a little bit about what we're seeing on the credit front and the down cycle that we're seeing in agriculture right now.
Go ahead, Mr. Knisley.
Mr. Chair, we are a federally chartered institution, so what we do at the state capitol primarily is on behalf of the 20,000-plus farm families that we represent as a cooperative. I'm here today to provide a little local color on some of what's going on in rural Minnesota and the agricultural economic conditions. Many of you are involved in agriculture, so that you know that the business is very cyclical. At times it can be very volatile, and it is a commodity business. So for the most part, our producers and farm families really don't have a lot of control over their input costs, and they don't have a lot of control over what they sell their end product for. So they're involved in managing risk to the best they can. Most farm families did a really good job of building working capital and liquidity during some a little more flush times in agriculture a number of years ago, but we just completed the third year of a downturn in commodity prices, and we're quickly working through most, if not all, of that working capital and liquidity. So, you know, producers are doing about the best they can with what they have right now. On average, I would say, even though we had exceptional yields last year across most of the state, there were pockets where we had some difficulty with production, but for the most part, our farmers had a pretty good year production-wise last year. And in general, even with the yields that we had, we still are seeing $50 to $75 an acre losses on every acre of corn that's produced in this state. So if you start to combine that and multiply that times multiple years in a row where we've had commodity prices at this level, you can see how it starts to eat away at the equity of the farm operations, as well as the liquidity and the cushion that's built in their working capital in the short-term portion of their balance sheet. our job as Farm Credit is really to provide sound and constructive financial assistance, loans, leases, financial services products. And, you know, we're trying to be very proactive in and have been very proactive in advising customers and farmers about the need to set aside when times are good for having a little bit of a nest egg to fall back on when we go through one of these downturns in the cycle. We've been very cautious about our lending, and I think most lenders have in rural Minnesota, making sure that we're not overextending producers and lending more debt or putting more debt on assets than what they can sustain long term. So I think for the most part, we've been very conscious of limiting the amount of debt and advising clients along those lines. And probably just as importantly, over the last couple of years, being very proactive in doing things like helping customers rebalance their debt. If they have liquidity and working capital shortfalls and they have equity in the other parts of their balance sheet, doing what we can to try and rebalance debt and extend the time that most producers and farm families have to sustain themselves through this downturn, because we clearly don't think we're at the end of this cycle yet from an economic standpoint. So I think on the presentation here, Jessica, if you want to go over some of the more specific things that we've been working on, then I can address any questions on the local economics after.
Thank you. You know, Mark mentioned that one of the things that we find very important is taking a proactive approach to servicing and a proactive approach to counseling and working with our borrowers. And so a lot of this gets to, you know, taking a look at options, evaluating what-if scenarios and providing certain plan Bs. We do a lot of kind of pro forma of an analysis in terms of if commodity prices are at certain different points, would you need to pull the trigger on a sale in order to break even? So we do a pretty thorough analysis on break even costs, possible, you know, if you do need to get your debt level down, asset sales, where are there possible asset sales? What are the tax implications to those? So we work through a lot of these different scenarios. When you get down to the debt and looking at, you know, are there options to restructure or rebalance the debt? You know, we've got a lot of tools in our tool case, and so, you know, we look at principal deferments, possibly doing interest-only payments for a year or two, to get those debt payments down. Mark mentioned repositioning debt, extending the amortization, maybe moving a short-term debt to a long-term debt and securing it by real estate assets or different things. So we look at kind of holistically what's the best approach and what do we need to do and how do we work together so that we can position our farmers for long-term success and make sure that their business is a sustainable business long-term. We also utilize partners and other risk management tools. FSA guarantees have been, one of a great tool that we use in terms of getting comfortable on the credit side and having that guarantee to back up that debt. The Minnesota Rural Finance Authority is another great partner that we use. Federal crop insurance is probably one of the best risk management tools that we have seen for our producers in terms of giving them that safety net if they have unexpected losses. And then, of course, farmer lender mediation in Minnesota. We certainly use that a lot to just get all the parties to the table and make sure that we're having constructive conversations in terms of how do we make this work for all of the parties. And then as a farm credit system, we offer unique borrower rights to all of our borrowers, which provide certain options of if there is a distressed credit, we have to provide them opportunity to restructure, conducting a least cost analysis in terms of what is better, restructure or moving to foreclosure. And so there's a number of kind of unique borrower rights that we provide to our borrowers just because we're part of the farm credit system.
If I could, Mr. Chair, also wanted to leave the committee with just some headline numbers here. We're looking at, for the most part, our producers at a break-even price for corn production of about $3.75 a bushel. Fall price yesterday was about $3.28. So that's the kind of hole that most of our producers are digging out of right now. And one of the biggest things, I know it's being considered at the legislature, but real estate taxes have really gotten out of hand for our producers. For the most part, we're seeing $30, $40, $50 an acre real estate taxes for most of these operations. And we have seen a couple of customers come in where they've been as high as $70 an acre, where they've had a school referendum, building referendum. So whatever you can do as a body to help mitigate that expense for our producers would be much appreciated. I know that is something that is a little bit more controllable in terms of how local government and schools are funded, and taking that burden off farmers would be a real benefit from our perspective. So just wanted to leave you with that high level number with the corn production. And I think last year, as we look back as we're looking at balance sheets and customer financials that are coming in right now, probably $50 to $75 an acre losses were pretty prevalent last year on average for our corn producers in rural Minnesota.
Question from Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your break even, we're using corn. What kind of a loan to value ratio from the land is driving into that number, break even number? I mean, I'm certain there's got to be some assumption that there is a certain amount of land purchase debt that's riding to create that break-even point.
Mr. Nisley?
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, it varies a lot. I'm talking about averages here. You have a lot of young operators that rent a lot of ground. They probably have a little higher cost ratio in terms of real estate, where it may make up a third of their cost of production. Some operators that have more of an owned real estate base may have a little bit lower carrying cost. But again, those are fixed costs that you need to be able to recoup. And rents are down. I think on average, as I talk to my peers across the state, I think rents are probably down 5 to 10%. So we are seeing some reductions, just voluntary reduction in cash rents. Real estate prices are probably, for the highest quality farm ground, off 25 or 30% from what the peak was. So we've seen a very gradual adjustment to the valuations. And the problem is once you've made that investment, it's there. You regardless of what things are selling for, you, if you have an investment at a certain level in real estate, it's going to remain at that level.
Follow-up, Representative.
Just a follow-up, then, is how much debt are you seeing as a kind of a generalization across the owned land that's being farmed?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we speak of this in terms of sustainable. You heard me mention that before. So we're looking at high-quality land as being able to sustain probably $300 to $3,500 an acre of debt. So when property in Renville County was selling for $10,000 or $12,000 a tillable acre a number of years ago, we were lending into that at a very low level, and producers were putting cash into it for the most part if they were paying that for real estate, which is their prerogative, and most of them have the wherewithal to be able to do that. But we really think from a sustainable standpoint, you don't want to get much above that $300 to $3,500 an acre level with debt on real estate.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. So I hear nothing but good things from people in my district about farm credit, and I have an AgStar office just down at the end of my street, and I've been there a few times, and hear really good things about the services that you provide. My question, though, is about looking at these prices and thinking about the ability to help farmers think about the future. And I'm interested in crop diversity and finding crops and, of course, markets that farmers can sell those perhaps new crops in. And I'm hearing that other, you know, General Mills, for instance, is interested in the development of Curzon, which is a perennial wheat. And then I also think about farmers who struggle to make ends meet and some of the opportunities that have been there with renewable energy, with windmills or wind turbines or solar, and thinking that that may be helpful to people. And I'm wondering what your institution might be able to do to encourage or further or be thinking with farmers about other ways of bringing in revenue than the kind of traditional cropping.
Mr. Nisley?
Mr. Chair and Representative, Farm Credit finances and serves every aspect of agriculture. So everything from the smallest organic truck farms to larger commercial operations. We don't discriminate in who we serve, and we have areas and specialists within each of our institutions that deal with within each of those areas. We have been very actively involved, all three associations, in supporting the local food initiatives that have taken place, whether they're community gardens or immigrant populations that seem to have a knack for doing a good job with vegetable production and some of those types of things, and farmers markets. So we're kind of putting our money where our mouth is in terms of making investments in things like food co-ops and local food shelves and food sheds and that type of thing, as well as sponsoring conferences and various other things for producers on that local food spectrum. The issue is, though, is that even if every one of our farmers did something with local food systems, that doesn't begin to feed the rest of the world. We don't have the infrastructure and the ability for some of our operations to be able to sell all of their production at a local food farmers market, as an example. So we have to make sure that we're doing all that we can to support every aspect of agriculture, but we have not overlooked that local food aspect and are very supportive of that.
And I would just add that as we talk about the alternative crops, the industrial hemp, the pennycress, these types of crops, we have to also develop markets that the farmer can sell these things at a profit. So thanks for those words.
If I could, Mr. Chair, the other thing I would add is the value-added things that farmers have done with ethanol and various food-grade things that are being done out in the country has really added value, and thankfully, because of ethanol and some of the other things that have been developed, we're in much better shape than we would be otherwise. I mean, we'd probably have, you know, a differential in that loss ratio of maybe twice what it is if we didn't have these other markets to deliver some of these commodities to.
Representative Black.
Yes, thank you. And I'm encouraged by many of the things that you talked about, and in my speaking with the people at AgStar in my town, I'm also aware that some of those things that they are actively involved in and encouraging. I am somewhat troubled about the whole notion that our farmers have to feed the world and that we have to be involved in that particular enterprise, because I think in some respects it's putting farmers in a very competitive world market that is very unpredictable. And we are seeing threats to that trade from certain policies in other countries. And although I don't question that we should be involved in world trade, we should be. I don't think that that's what I'm trying to say. But I think to use the argument that we must feed the world isn't necessarily going to help those other countries develop their own ability to feed themselves, and also to help us develop a more secure farm economy here in the United States. I think there's a lot that we can do to help farmers find a more secure market into the future. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. And I think we need to be thinking about how can we make our farm economy more nimble and more able to respond to changes that happen. So I'll just offer that.
I think that's a discussion for another day. We have to move along quickly here. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that you have, thanks for the presentation today, and thanks for talking about the partners that you utilize, and especially like in the farmer lender mediation and others like that. And we had a question about farm business management, and if you have any, obviously I'm thinking that you must have some connection to FBM instructors throughout the state, and that you maybe would provide any credit to farmers that use FBM, or if you have any requirements that you might have for them to do that.
Ms. Martin?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yeah, farm business management is another tool. It wasn't listed up there, but it's one that many of our clients across all three associations use. The benchmarking that they have available and that data is also is something that our team members utilize from a standpoint of looking at credit and comparatives as we're working with clients. We have internal benchmarking, but that farm business management benchmarking also comes into play. In addition to that, to answer your question about clients that work with farm business management, the answer is yes. I can think of a few just off the top of head that have partnered with us and farm business management, a young farmer couple in my area in particular, just recently, and they were able to purchase a farm and do it by having a group of partners that helped them, and farm business management played a role in that. So absolutely. And Representative Bly left, I was going to address one thing that I think it's important for all of us to remember, that when we talk about our partners and those that we work with to serve our clients, we're also viewed as a partner as well. And so as our clients are making decisions on planting or what inputs they're going to use or land purchases, we're one of their partners as well. And so we can provide information, we can provide perspectives and expertise on a variety of areas. But as they're making decisions, they're also looking to seed dealers to learn about new traits or opportunities. They're looking at market opportunities and using advisors there. So we're part of their toolbox as well. And so we do all that we can to help look at emerging markets and look at opportunities for them and provide expertise. But ultimately, our clients are going to make the decisions that are right for their farms and their families. And we're happy to be that long-term partner with them.
Mr. Nisley.
Mr. Chair and Representative, all of the associations also either offer, through our charters, we're authorized to provide record-keeping services and tax preparation. So we either offer that service directly, or in some cases we work with outside firms, to commercial firms, to offer that to our customers. And particularly with the young beginning farmers, which we're all very focused on, all three associations subsidize record keeping, as an example. We all feel that's extremely important from a farm business management standpoint, particularly for the younger producers and young farmers to get a grasp on their business and understand their business. So we all strongly encourage the use of good records, and farm business management provided by the state and through the state college university system is very helpful.
Final questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you for your excellent presentation. And next up, Department of Agriculture, the Farm Safety Report. Getting the PowerPoint lined up and ready to go. Good morning. Identify yourself if you're ready and proceed. I guess we aren't quite ready. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Vobel. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Can you hear me okay? Okay. So I am here today to talk about the current status of farm safety here in Minnesota. It's a follow-up of a legislative report that we were asked to write last legislative session. I also have a few folks of our farm safety working group here, so they'll be able to answer all the tough questions you have for us. So. Thank you.
Is the hard copy we have the same as your PowerPoint?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
We could go by that.
Okay, that sounds good. I'll just pull my number.
It's Farm Safety in Minnesota is the...
So yes, as I mentioned, it's a follow-up of a 2016 legislative report request from the body. They were asked to report and analyze common causes of farm-related accidents, information about how other Midwestern states address farm safety issues, and also recommendations for improving farm safety and farm safety programs. And that does include identifying how farm safety programs can better serve the growing farm labor population, as well as recommendations on how to improve farm safety efforts in Minnesota. So as I mentioned, we relied heavily upon our farm safety working group. We had it's kind of an informal collaboration between state agencies, higher education institutions, ag member organizations, and others. And it kind of came out of just some informal discussions where we thought we should all get together with people who have a stake in this game to talk about how we can come together collectively to work on strategies to improve ag safety here in Minnesota. And so just a list of a few folks who are part of that farm safety working group, and again, a number of them are here today. The Minnesota Safety Council, the Upper Midwest Agricultural Safety and Health Center, or as we call it, UMASH, MEALC, the Minnesota Ag Education Leadership Council, University of Minnesota Extension, Equipalife, the United Food and Commercial Workers, Minnesota Farmers Union, the Minnesota South Dakota Equipment Dealers Association, a number of insurance companies, the Southern Minnesota Center of Agriculture, the Latino Economic Development Center, and then, of course, folks from the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. So some common causes of farm-related fatalities in Minnesota. From 2004 to 2014, there were over 210 fatalities related to agriculture in Minnesota. And so the graph that you'll see there is data for it came from the Star Tribune series, the four-part series that was published in 2015 called Tragic Harvest. So of those 210 fatalities, 35% were attributed to tractor accidents, 6% were attributed to livestock, 9% to grain bin and silo accidents, 15% to environmental. And environmental examples would be drowning, electrocution, falls, fire, and potential chemical exposure. Other would be 16%, and that's blunt force injuries, crushing injuries, those types of things. And then other vehicles were 19%. And so it kind of breaks that down a little bit more, 7% to ATV, 5% to trucks, and 7% to skid loaders. So you'll see over 50% were attributed to vehicle-related deaths. Other risk factors for farm-related deaths are age. So over 65 accounts for about 41% of that 210. Gender, 94% were male, and the season usually typically happened between May and October, and particularly in the month of July. I should mention, and I'll get into it in a little bit more, it is very difficult for us to figure out how injuries and illnesses are impacted by farm safety issues, and I'll get into that a little bit more. So we were asked to compare Minnesota to other Midwestern states, so we focused mostly on Iowa, Nebraska, and Wisconsin. All have NIOSH agricultural centers, and NIOSH is the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and the one that we have here in the Upper Midwest in Minnesota is UMASH. Iowa and Wisconsin have state-mandated and funded farm safety centers, so ICASH is in Iowa, it's the Iowa Center for Agricultural Safety and Health, and that was originally funded as a state budget line item but was cut, but is now routed through for $250,000 through their university. Wisconsin has UW-CASH, which is the University of Wisconsin Center for Agricultural Safety and Health. They did have a $100,000 budget item, which was ultimately cut, and now it's routed through their extension services. Minnesota and Wisconsin have active ROPS rebate programs. Iowa and Nebraska are in the process of trying to establish one in their states as of right now. And then I'll just get right into the recommendations. So our number one recommendation was to continue the ROPS rebate program and explore expansion of rebates to other farm safety equipment. So the 2016 ROPS rebate program that was set into place last session was a very big success, and I think it indicates the need and willingness of farmers to address and improve farm safety on their farms. Just a few numbers as of Friday when we got the latest, we did have over 414 intakes. And intakes means somebody who just calls the hotline and wants to know more information. We might take their information down, ask what kind of tractor they have, and gather information. So I think that just indicates the level of interest from farmers around the state in Minnesota. We have cut 85 checks, so there are 85 folks who have retrofitted tractors, and then we do have 79 who are on the waiting list. And again, I think we've talked about how other equipment could also be outfitted with safety measures. That could include tie-off kits for silos, harnesses and lifelines, or what's called FOPS, falling object protective structures for front-end loaders. And we really feel like, because this legislation is written as of right now, MDA is able to reimburse for up to 70%, and we can go over the 70% to cap off the farmer's out-of-pocket expense at $500. And ROPs have been proven to be 99% effective in the cases of a rollover incident, and so we feel like that farmers seem to be interested in making that investment for such a good return. Number two is to reestablish the statewide University of Minnesota Extension farm safety faculty position. Again, there was someone who was in that position in the 1990s and 2000s, and they served as a key link in connecting industry, government, and community folks. They were really focused on research and outreach. And again, they were key to delivering those farm safety programs. In 2008, that person did leave for another opportunity, and at this point, it has not been refilled. Number three is to establish support for UMASH. As I mentioned, it stands for the Upper Midwest Agricultural Safety and Health Center, and they do serve a number of states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and the Dakotas. They're a multidisciplinary collaboration of five leading research and healthcare institutions in the Upper Midwest, and that does include the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine, the National Farm Medicine Center of the Marshfield Clinic, which is located in Wisconsin, the Migrant Clinicians Network, and the Minnesota Department of Health. They've been a major leader for Minnesota as far as farm safety efforts go. They've done a lot on research, and we would really like to establish a little bit more support for them so they can spend a lot more time here in Minnesota. Number four, as I mentioned a little bit before, it's to improve data collection about farm illnesses, injuries, and fatalities. So the Minnesota Department of Health was investigating farm deaths until using federal funding until it ended in 2006, and that was called the Fatality Assessment and Control Evaluation, or the FACE program, which you may have heard of before. In 2014, MDH developed and pilot tested a method to track injuries using hospital discharge data. And again, we don't have a lot of solid data as far as injuries and illnesses go. Part of that has to do with, you know, a lot of farmers may not even go to the hospital if they get injured. They might, for whatever reason, financial issues. They might not want to take time off the farm if they're, you know, working under a time crunch. Some folks might not report it as ag-related. They might not say that, you know, what happened to them was because of something they were doing on the farm. Again, with our growing farm population, some folks are afraid to say that it was something that they got through their work on the farm. And also sort of the issues with marking the long-term illnesses. So hearing loss, respiratory issues, long-term exposure to chemicals is another thing that's difficult to track for us. So if there was more, if there was an improvement in that area, I think it would help us figure out where to put certain resources. Number five is to promote the existing Department of Labor and Industries Workplace Safety Consultation Program to farmers. So this is an already existing program. It's free, voluntary, and it's all confidential. So they are consultations, and it's very separate from their compliance division. I know folks hear OSHA, and they get scared. But this program is an employer would call the Department of Labor and Industry, ask for an on-site visit, so staff would come out, assess their operation, and help them identify potential hazards and ways that they can improve safety on their farm. And Dolly folks are really trying to target more farmers in this particular program. They are qualified farmers are eligible for dollar-for-dollar match up to $10,000 to help them implement those safety measures to improve safety on the farm. Again, if you know someone comes out on the farm, they're not going to be issuing citations for things that they find unless it's something obviously very majorly a concern. But farmers can feel safe that someone will come out and it'll be good. Oh, good, it's back up. Thank you, Mark.
Just in time.
Yes.
Maybe we should stay there, Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some more recommendations. One is to create a farm safety certification program. So a lot of you are familiar with the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program. Iowa and North Carolina also have something called the Certified Safe Farm. And we just wanted to, the Farm Safety Working Group thought it would be good to just explore this option of, you know, potentially recognizing farmers who participate in something like maybe the Workplace Safety Consultation Program or something similar to it, and may potentially provide some sort of financial incentives to folks, maybe cuts in their insurance premiums or something along those lines, you know, a certain thing at the end of their driveway that says they're a certified safe farm. Just trying to brainstorm ways to incentivize folks to get involved and certify their farm as safe. And building off of that, investigate financial incentives to increase farm safety measures. So we'd like to look into approaching insurance providers about potentially lowering insurance premiums for farmers who might go through some sort of program, similar to the reduction that older drivers might receive for going to safe driving classes. Research and improve programs for a changing farm labor population. As I mentioned, it's a growing population all around the state. And so there are barriers to those folks receiving the information that they need, whether it's language barriers, internet access issues. A lot of materials are available online, and a lot of folks don't have access to that in some of the rural areas. And so we've talked about developing a community health worker program, similar to something that UMASH has worked on, that's for immigrant dairy workers on health and safety. So encouraging certain organizations such as the Hmong American Farmers Association, Latino Economic Development Center to kind of take a look at those things and help us figure out what needs those immigrant farmer populations could use to be safer on the farm. Encourage and support programs offered by allied industries and organizations. Part of the farm safety initiative we had last year was we were asked to put sort of a clearinghouse of resources on our website that folks who were looking for information on farm safety could go to our website and find a long list of those things. And so I think kind of we identified through that process that there are a lot of folks doing really great things on farm safety. And so I think continuing to promote and encourage those folks who are already working on this important issue, but also kind of tapping into those folks that the farmers do see every day, the folks that they trust, their farm business management instructors, their, you know, equipment dealers, their veterinarians, folks like that who might be able to, people that they see frequently, that they trust, they can get that information from. Promote existing training programs and expand educational opportunities for 4-H, FFA, and beginning farmer education programs. We've talked about this before, I think, but 4-H and FFA particularly have done a wonderful job, and some of the general farm organizations, on just teaching the youth and trying to make sure that that's something that they just incorporate into their lives as they start work on the farm is really important. So we want to, Farm Safety Working Group and MDA really want to make sure that that's still something that's encouraged and promoted. Create a coordinated media campaign. So again, I think it's difficult. We talk about in the report that a lot of these things, and some of these are very similar recommendations. We've been starting 30 years ago, late 80s, working on issues like this. How do we reach the farm population to encourage increased safety efforts on the farm? And I think there are, you know, there's certain things that have worked and things that haven't. We, you know, talked a lot about potentially trying to talk to farmers sort of about the economic impact, and there isn't a whole lot of data out there about the economic impact when there are injuries and deaths in terms of loss of productivity and other things. But I think that's something that maybe farmers would respond to, as well as just personalizing it in terms of, you know, you may have been doing this your whole life and know how to do this, but, you know, your kids and your grandkids are watching, and they could really use a role model to see what it is that you're doing to be safe on the farm. And so I think a coordinated media campaign to kind of reach those outlets that farmers and youth are looking at and reading and listening to would be really helpful. And finally, to continue the Farm Safety Working Group. As I mentioned, it was just we relied very heavily on them to write this report. They are the real experts out in the field talking to farmers about all these issues. And I think it's really important to have that forum where we can come up with collective ideas and strategize about how to increase ag safety here in Minnesota. So with that, I am happy to take any questions. And again, folks are here if there's anything specific I can't answer.
Thanks for the report. Important report, very good report. Thanks for your work and the department's work. And also thanks to Representative Johnson for authoring that legislation just a year ago that got going on this and really put the spotlight on the topic of farm safety. And I think a lot of these recommendations could be built on and followed up with not a whole lot of additional expense, but we just have to keep the emphasis and the spotlight on this topic. So thank you. Questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Representative Anderson, and thank you, Ms. Bobble. But largely what I want to say is thank you to the department for taking this on and doing it so thoroughly and so quickly. And I think particularly the working group, I hear that was key. And so there's a bunch of people who really jumped in and did the job. You know, too often we hear about how things are slow, and I probably get as frustrated as anybody around here about how slow state government can be, or I felt that when I taught at Minnesota State doing it. But this is a good example where people work together and really grabbed a hold of something that's so important when we're looking at fatalities, and then you're talking about the lost productivity on the farm. This is, I always thought of it in the human impact, but the economic impact is significant. Could you just talk a little bit more about what you learned about that, the economic impact of problems with farm safety?
Absolutely. And I have some figures, I think, from the Minnesota Department of Health. Researchers at the Department of Health found that costs of injury and illness in the agricultural sector range between $21 and $31 million annually, and that's mostly attributed to indirect costs, such as low productivity at work. So I think really folks do that. That's a key piece, I think, in getting farmers to understand not only, you know, their safety and well-being, but also just the impact that it has for their, not only their operation, but their surrounding communities.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you. And I think, at least in my mind related, is do we have data on the number of people who are hired hands or hired workers on farms over time? Do we have any data that shows how many more employees are working on farms today compared to 10 years ago, 20 years ago, et cetera? It certainly feels like there's been an increase. That's my assumption, but can you affirm that?
Ms. Bobble?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we talked a little bit about this in the report, and I can certainly get you that number to show you sort of the trends. I don't have that with me right now. But I think sometimes it varies. As we mentioned in the report, there are some folks who report up to 1 million agricultural workers. Others, it's 3 million. So there's quite a big difference in reported numbers. A lot of those are seasonal if they're perhaps working on a crop operation, but the livestock farmers usually have a year-round agricultural workers.
Follow up again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my point is more Minnesota. I'm curious about Minnesota.
Got it.
And I think it is also interesting to me the nature of work in Minnesota is different mm-hmm. than what we think of in those millions of workers. That it's different than what we would see in California or in the state of Washington, mm-hmm. and the type of work and the nature of work they're doing. Is there any effort to get a hold of that? You know, to come to a better understanding of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think Cindy, do you know? Okay. Well, we'll get that information for you. I'm almost positive we've got it somewhere, so I'll find that for you and send it to you.
Very good. Thank you very much for the report. Question from Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, you spoke to farm injuries. So I'm not sure who pays for that. I mean, if you are an owner-operated, you are exempt from work comp. But do you know how many of these farm injuries are covered by workers' compensation versus, I guess, maybe personal health plans or personal liability plans, business liability plans?
Ms. Bobble?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I can certainly get you more information on that. I'm almost positive. I know for at least the Workplace Safety Consultation Program, an employer does have to have workers' comp insurance. So I think frequently a lot of that is covered by workers' comp insurance. And I can get you information on that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. Yes, I would like to kind of understand how that works a little bit more. You say on the Work Comp Council, and I I've never seen the farmers come by the Work Comp Council in the 8 years I've been on it, and it would be interesting to see how many employees are out there on that, on follow through on that. Then the other question is, I do kind of want to understand how, if somebody is injured on a farm, you know, a small 300-acre farm that typically is just a family-run operation, you know, are they going through, who's paying for that injury? And is it a personal liability? Is it a business liability? Is it a health care cost that goes on, you know, the Blue Cross Blue Shield or wherever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, as you said, I mean, I think it kind of depends on the operation they have. If it's a smaller one, they might not have, it might just be the family that's running it, then it likely would probably be just a personal health care insurance package that they have. But I can certainly check on that for you.
Last question. We have to move along. Representative South.
Just a quick one. This may be a suggestion or it might be something that is in here I didn't see, and that has to do with new employee safety instruction or safety training, anything that would be in that model. Almost every industrial job I've gone to, I've gone through at least like a half a day or a day of getting acquainted, and the safety elements were the things that were highlighted. So just a
yes,
comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, I mean, I think that's the work a lot of, you know, folks like the University of Minnesota Extension and UMass and others that would help prepare materials that employers could use for those types of situations. So certainly it's something that we'd want to be investing in.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Ms. Vabel. Next up, we have a presentation from Land O'Lakes and a program they call Soil Advantage. And a little background of why they're here. I sat with the Land O'Lakes folks at the chamber dinner early in the session and got visiting with Rebecca Keenow, and we got talking about agriculture and farming and sustainability, and it turns out she is the director of sustainability for Land O'Lakes, which is one of our bigger ag companies in the state, ag cooperative, and she graciously agreed to come and present to us the software they have that would help farmers establish alternative practices in relation to water quality. I thought it would have been was a good topic to hear in the committee. And today is a day, if we can get things working.
Yep.
Anyway, good morning. Identify yourselves and proceed with your presentation. And thanks for being here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Becky Keenow, and I'll let Tom introduce himself.
Good morning. I'm Tom Buhman with Agwin.
Go ahead.
Okay. As the Representative Anderson said, I serve as the Director of Sustainability for Land O'Lakes in our newly formed business unit, which is focused on environmental sustainability. And we did have a great conversation the other night, so I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee and tell you a little bit about Land O'Lakes, and then we'll go into discussion about the software. So sustainability and stewardship has really been a foundational building block of Land O'Lakes business since its inception in 1921. Land O'Lakes is a farmer-owned cooperative with industry-leading products that span the spectrum from agricultural production to consumer foods. I'm sure many of you have heard about our main business unit, the one that everybody knows about, which is our Land O'Lakes Dairy Foods. But we also own Purina Animal Nutrition and Winfield United, and along with our newest one, Land O'Lakes Sustain. We've been in operation for 95 years, and we do business in all 50 states, reaching more than 300,000 U.S. farms across the country. And we also operate in 60 different countries. We are ranked number 215 on the Fortune 500 list. So we are a very large company. And in here in Minnesota, we have a strong presence and a strong network. We have over 2,300 employees, 107 local cooperatives, 422 independent ag service members, and 354 dairy members who produce 1.45 billion pounds of milk annually. We also operate multiple facilities in Minnesota, which include our corporate headquarters in Arden Hills, dairy manufacturing facilities in Melrose and Pine Island, feed mills in Detroit Lakes and Invergrove Heights in Wilmer, and distribution service centers in Lewiston, Plymouth, and Winthrop, Minnesota. We're currently working across our entire farm member base and our product line to promote sustainable practices. Just hit on a couple of the highlights. We're working with member dairies to conduct on-farm sustainability analyses, which were kind of modeled on the Innovation Center for U.S. Dairy's sustainability framework. To date, we have 35% of Land O'Lakes milk supply that's had its environmental footprint assessed. We're also developing cutting-edge precision agricultural platforms through our Winfield United business and improving feed efficiency and animal nutrition through our Purina Animal Nutrition business. And most recently, creating a new business unit. This happened back in August 1st in 2016, Land O'Lakes Sustain, which will focus on helping to ensure sustainable crop production by delivering insights, products, and services, and enhancing sustainability within our dairy foods and feed business, and then partnering with other entities, including government, to improve efficiency and collaboration on conservation and sustainability programs at the farm level. So Land O'Lakes, you may have heard, recently entered into a first-of-its-kind public-private partnership with the state of Minnesota to help deliver conservation and sustainability programs to help protect and improve water quality across Minnesota. The partnership connects the state of Minnesota's Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program with Land O'Lakes Retail Network to basically expand the outreach and improve water quality and stewardship at the farm level. We use our tools and technologies and insights to enable prudent nutrient and soil management and delivery of those through our different businesses, Winfield, United, Sustain, and the Soil Vantage portfolio, which Tom will be talking more about here shortly. Really, goals of this partnership were to increase the awareness of the program and bring to scale more adoption and inclusion in the program by our farmers. And we're really expanding our reach throughout our network. And hopefully this will be an opportunity to create a national model that others could look to. So some key components of our precision agriculture and precision conservation offerings are this cutting-edge data collection and analysis capabilities, which help ag retailers and farmers make decisions that help them to optimize their yield or outputs using less inputs. Today you'll hear more about our Soil Vantage portfolio, which we believe will help farmers make better, more informed decisions related to soil and water management that will ultimately help water quality improvement efforts here in the state of Minnesota. So the Soil Vantage portfolio was developed in partnership with Agrin, and I've asked Tom Dewan to join us here, and he's the one who's worked with this company, has developed the science and technology behind it, so I'll provide you with an overview of the tool.
Thank you, Becky.
Yep. Mr. Dewan, go ahead.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and committee, it is truly a pleasure to be here to talk about our software. I'm very excited about it. A little bit of background. I am the CEO of Agrin. We're a small company, about 12 people, located in West Central Iowa. Our goal really is to revolutionize the delivery of conservation systems. That is our mission of our company, and we really are serious about that. A little bit of background about me. I'm just a farm kid from Southwest Iowa. I was raised by a dad who believed in conservation, and he instilled conservation in his five sons as we worked on the farm. It was logical. I'd go to Iowa State University. I majored in agronomy, and after I graduated, I worked for USDA's, what was then the Soil Conservation Service and now the Natural Resources Conservation Service. I worked for them for 14 years. And then I felt like I was getting a little stagnant in my career, and I wasn't helping farmers enough. And so I decided to start my own business called Agrin, which stands for Agriculture and the Environment, and helped privatize conservation services. So we've been in business for 20 years, and the first 15 years I would describe us more as a consulting firm, and the last 5 years more as a software company that's really helping ag retail deliver conservation services to farmers. So we all know about the pressures on farmers, right? It seems like every day you get up and you open the paper, there is a new report about how agriculture is damaging the natural resources. And I'm not here to tell you that's not true. I'm not speaking for Land O'Lakes, speaking for myself and my background. Agriculture does contribute to environmental problems. They are part of the problem. They need to be part of the solution. But I think it's unfortunate how much attention is being placed there, and I think it really points out of what farmers need. I also think the food companies are demanding more sustainable products on their shelf, right? Unilever is looking for 100% sustainably sourced soybeans, whatever that means. You know, Kellogg's is wanting to put better products, more sustainable products in their cereal box. And so I think we see farmers being like double, it's kind of on both sides, right? We want better products to put in cereal boxes on one side, and then we're getting pressure and water quality on the other side. And I think they're really in a tough spot. And so as I see it, the problem is really a lack of technical assistance. Conservation is complicated. It's not an easy thing. It's a lot like medicine. You just don't get up one morning and understand conservation and the best practices to apply out there. And so if we look at the public sector funding, I can tell you, at least on a federal level, it's really dipped. And so the question is, if farmers are getting more pressure for more conservation and be at their kitchen table what matters, right? That technical assistance is what really helps. When they're getting more demands on them to do more conservation and our workforce is declining in the public sector, what are they expected to do? And then the private sector would say, okay, let's just Land O'Lakes, go ahead and pick this up and you guys do it. But somehow they have to get paid to do it. But more than that, there needs to be an infrastructure for them to use. I just point this graph out that when I started working for NRCS in the early 80s, to today, there are 30% less full-time equivalents across the nation, a third less people helping farmers, and we've seen the demand for services go up, and so it really puts farmers, I think, in somewhat of a crisis. So these are the questions that keep me up at night, right? What's sustainability? I mean, is it water quality? Is it soil health? Is it butterflies? Is it pollinators? What exactly is sustainability to a farmer? Because that word means a lot of different things. What growers should participate, and why should they participate, right? Should they just wait till regulation to come to them? That's how some of them feel. You know, how do we scale this idea of conservation? How do we get it to a level that's meaningful to farmers? And lastly, who should provide these services? So when I think about who should provide these services, I go to this graph, and I have been thinking about this for a lot of years. So this is a survey that was done by 10 land-grant colleges in the upper Midwest, and we've all seen statistics like this before, right? You ask farmers, who is your most trusted advisor? When you need help, who do you go to? Well, number one, it's family, but after you get to family, overwhelmingly, it's their ag retailer. I mean, overwhelmingly, they point out that it's their seed dealer and their ag retailer who they want to go to help for. It is their most trusted advisor. So today, ag retailers have a lot on their plate, right? They have all the things they've traditionally done. They have populations of hybrids and herbicides and insecticides, and now they're doing nutrient management plans and planting prescriptions. And we want to throw sustainability into this too? Well, I think the reason we want to is this was a survey done by Iowa State University of Iowa farmers, so it doesn't include Minnesota farmers, but I assume it'd be the same. They asked farmers, so do you want your ag retailers to help you keep nutrients out of water? 60% of farmers said, yes, I want my ag retailer to be more engaged in water quality issues and helping me. 30% said, yeah, I don't know. And only 10% said, no, I don't think that's their job. So you have 90% of the population saying somewhere between, and yeah, that's a really good idea. And so I think it's really these ag retailers, right, that have to step up and begin to provide services. I liken this to going back to, you know, my days when I was at Iowa State University and my dad called me up and I was working for Iowa State Agronomy Department. He said, Tom, what's this black cutworm that we're reading about? I have an outbreak in my field. And I said, Dad, I don't know anything about it. Call Iowa State Extension. And he did, and they came out and fixed the problem. My brother would not call Extension for black cutworm today. He's going to call his local ag retailer, right? We think sustainability issues and soil conservation issues need to go the same direction. So our company has really worked on this idea of precision conservation, about how do we maximize environmental benefit from practices that farmers apply and minimize the investment they need to make. We just heard about the farm economy, right? And farmers don't have a lot of cash sitting around. So it's really important we think about how we maximize the benefits of conservation practices while minimizing the investment that they make. So we set out to develop a suite of tools, and I'll just go through those quickly. One of them is Pond Builder. When I used to work for the agency, it would take me 30 hours to design a pond. With our software and the help of the LIDAR data that you guys purchased a few years back, the topographic data, we have got that from the state of Minnesota. We can design a pond in 15 minutes for 30 hours. Right? Basin Builder for water and sediment control basins. We can design a basin in 10 or 15 minutes. A wetland, same thing. And then a waterway. Waterway is a little more complicated, but instead of spending 8 or 10 hours out in the field, I can spend at a computer about a half an hour and come up with a great grass waterway design for a farmer. But at Agrin, it's not about just stopping at a design and having a farmer a piece of paper and saying your waterway is 40 feet wide and 2 foot deep. We want to help them move on and with implementation. And so we're working on things like blade control, right? So if you don't know what blade control is, next time you're driving during construction season down the interstate and the graders and the dozers out there and they have these GPS units on either side of the blade, what happened is some genius engineer figured out way ahead of time what the interstate was going to be graded like. They created a three-dimensional model, right? They plugged it into a little thumb drive. And when they go out and they get in the dozer, they plug it into the controller, and the blade moves up and down, and it tips and it tilts so that the interstate gets graded just like that three-dimensional product was previous to that. Well, when we design a waterway, we can do the same thing. We can create a three-dimensional thing that goes into some of the companies you have, like Cat Ziegler here in the cities and RDO with TopCon. And the same thing, we can help farmers mechanize what they're doing by working with that contractor who has this blade control. And we can cut a third of the cost off of building these grass waterways. And we don't have to send a team of people out to the field to stake this waterway because it's all built by satellites. So really cool technology. Right? So the most proud thing I am of is our soil calculator. And I'll talk a few minutes about our soil calculator. When I worked for the agency, and still yet today, there is a model that predicts soil erosion, and it's called Russell, Revised Universal Soil Loss Equation, version 2. Right? So we took this equation, and we were looking at it, and we're like, okay, the way this works is you go out in the field, and you choose one spot in the field, and you gather all the criteria that goes into the model, and you run the model, and you say your soil loss is 8 tons per acre per year, 5 tons, or whatever it is. And the farmer's sitting there going, well, that's what it is here, but what is it over there? And we're not very good at helping them understand spatially how erosion works. It's a little bit like 30 years ago when we wanted to help farmers understand what their yield was going to be, and we'd go out and hand harvest a tenth of an acre of ground, and we'd say, your yield is going to be about 160 bushels per acre, and they're like, well, that's what it is here, but what is it over there? We've done the same thing as their yield maps. We've created an erosion map. We run in 160 acres, we run that model 7,000 times so that we know spatially where soil erosion is occurring, and then we can make recommendations for them. So as you follow across, the first one is kind of an aggressive tillage system and a corn bean rotation. The next one, we put some terraces in the bottom end of the photo, and then the last one, it's complete no-till. So they can really understand, do I have erosion in one spot, and do I need to just kind of treat one spot of my field, or is erosion occurring everywhere, and do I need to manage them more with no-till or cover crops? And so we're very proud of this tool, and then we can map out, just like yield, we can map out what's the level of soil erosion, and when you change different practices, how does that change? And then this is a tabular report that we have. And if you can follow through, I'll just do alternative one. You know, you always try and establish what the baseline is. And so their average soil loss in this field is 7 tons per acre per year, 6.9 tons, based on what they're doing. But, you know, that doesn't mean much. What is it on a really highly erodible area? Well, on that area, 16.5 tons per acre. So it's not just like you can choose one point in a field and say what it is. And we don't really like this tons per acre soil loss. It doesn't make sense. I mean, what's a ton of soil and what's an acre of ground, and how do I figure this out? So we've tried to put it in inches of loss over 10 years. So in alternative one, they're losing about a half an inch of topsoil over 10 years across that entire field. But in that top 20 most erosive area, they're losing over an inch of topsoil. So if I were going to farm for 30 years and I lose 3 inches of topsoil there, I've lost half of what I got left, right? I might have 5 or 6 inches, and I've lost half of that. And so we think it's really important from a long run, we project it in inches per loss. We also have a whole suite of tools under development, and I'll talk about the buffer builder and the sediment tracker a little bit here. But first off, the sediment tracker. So I don't want to get into the weeds too much, but it's hard to talk about conservation without talking about details. This is our soil calculator that I showed before. We calculate soil erosion 7,000 times in 160 acres. So this is a 320-acre field. And what's interesting about soil erosion is most people that aren't in the know think if I have erosion, it goes through a stream or river. That's not the case. We have a lot of soil that moves 10, 15, 20 feet, 30 feet, 150 feet, and it gets redeposited. I mean, think of soil as your water's running down your hill. You have a steep hill. The water's running faster. It has more energy. It picks up more soil particles, more erosion, carries it off. But then it hits the bottom of that hill, right? And the water slows down because it's not as steep, doesn't have as much energy in the water, and you drop sediment out. So in this picture, if you can see it, all the black dots is where sediment's being dropped out of the water. So just because you have erosion doesn't mean that sediment's getting to the water. Now, there certainly are cases where it is. That's why we have cloudy and muddy water, right? But it's important to be able to track what sediment is getting to the stream or river and what sediment's not. And so we developed this tool called Sediment Tracker, and it's really pretty cool because it helps us understand the sediment that's being delivered. Where in the landscape is it coming from? And so at the bottom end to the upper left hand, if I have that right, if I have my directions right, we don't see much sediment getting there, and so a buffer along the stream there is not much use. But at the upper end of this stream, that's really where we're getting the sediment delivery, and that's where a farmer needs to focus. And so it really helps us work with Land O'Lakes to help farmers understand where they need to focus in their field to keep sediment out. And 1 acre is not the same as another acre. There are high priority acres, just like there are high yielding areas, there are high erosion areas that sediment is being delivered to the stream. Okay? So let's just take, to wrap it up, 320 acres here. If we were going to put in a 50-foot wide buffer, it's going to take 10 acres out of land, and I forget the Farm Credit Services say how much an acre of land is, but let's say $8,000. This farmer's got $80,000 invested in it, and there's probably half that buffer that doesn't really apply very well to the farmer. I mean, it's not that it's worthless. I mean, it does something, but you could take that buffer and you could put it somewhere else to do a better job. And so when we take the combination of soil calculator and sediment tracker, what we find out is that this Mike Dosky, he's a professor, and he works for U.S. Forest Service, which is odd. He works in agriculture working for the Forest Service. But he studied buffers for a long time. And he said, you know what? If we took, like, the continuous 50-foot wide or 100-foot wide buffer, and we redistributed that grass, and we put it where it was most important, if you needed 10 acres to achieve a certain water quality, if we redistributed that grass on average, we would only need 4 acres of grass to achieve the same water quality benefits. That is intriguing to me. Now, that's an average, right? The range is huge, and every farm is different. So you can't say every farmer would benefit this much. Some farmers benefit more. Some don't. But that's the importance of really easy-to-use software so we can pinpoint those areas and really hone in on those areas to help us out. And so then we can design buffers that look like this, right? So they explode in areas. They get bigger in areas where we need that extra filtration. And maybe they're non-existent in other areas. Okay? So this is a mock-up that I did of some variable width buffers that I think, you know, we're in the process of building it. We have a contract with Land O'Lakes to build it for them. But this is a mock-up of kind of what I think it would look like on this field. The other thing we can do, instead of buffers, we have other options that are available to us, like putting in structures so that where we have concentrated flow coming down and it's delivering a lot of sediment to a stream or river, we can go across that draw and we can put in a water sediment control basin and the water gets stored there for 24 hours and the silt drops out and the water then runs onto the stream or river a lot cleaner. And so that's another mechanism that we can do. And this is what this site would look like. I could put in, this site, I could put in 3 water and sediment control basins and probably get twice the half the sediment delivery as if I put in a buffer. Okay? The other option is to go with a corn bean rotation with no-till, right? This is what an aggressive tillage system looks like in soil erosion. This is what a no-till system looks like. And so I really like the idea of alternative practices where you give farmers a bench line of what 50-foot buffers, you know, that's kind of a bench line of what you need to achieve. But then you say there's a whole lot of things that are available to help you out. And there are different solutions. And just like healthcare, there are different solutions to all of our healthcare needs. There are different solutions to our conservation needs. And so as we work with Land O'Lakes, we truly believe that ag retailers, the tagline should be, sustainability is the crop input of tomorrow. We firmly believe that. So with that, I would wrap it up.
Thank you. Mr. Boomen, thank you. That was fascinating that you can use these tools, come up with methods that work as well, and possibly use less land to accomplish the same things. And how do we move this out commercially to make it more available?
Well, and that's where we're working hand in hand with Becky, and Becky might be better to address that than me.
Mr. Chair, yes, we are in the process of packaging this up, and like I say, the soil, we call it Soil Vantage at Land O'Lakes, and we will, the buffer builder piece is still in development, but by the end of March should be operational, we hope, right?
Yes. Yeah, so, absolutely.
And be able to start working with our ag retailers and having folks that are working with them to talk about these tools and technologies and start here in Minnesota. We'd love to, you know, expand well beyond Minnesota, but we'd like to get some test cases running here in Minnesota, so we're looking at opportunities to do that in the state.
Any conversations with Bowser? Now, they're the agency tasked with coming up with alternative practices for our buffer law. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all know that situations can be different, and you seem to be able to tailor-made solutions. Mm-hmm. Any conversation with Bowser in this state to use some of the technology you're developing?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, yes, we have started those conversations, and I'll let Tom also talk about the conversations he's had with them, but on the buffer piece of the buffer builder piece of this, we're kind of have a placeholder, but then waiting till we want to have the technology pretty well in hand so that we had the documentation and all to present to them. But we do plan to get into to have some significant conversations with them. But
yes, Mr. Boomen. Sure. Yeah, we definitely have talked to them, but I think it's too early for us. I mean, we are still developing the software, and we want to make sure that we have a complete picture of how it is. So we have an agreement. We have a contract with Land O'Lakes that by the end of March we'll have this wrapped up, and we'll be able to then start talking to Bowser. And one of the things that I'm most proud of is that our software is based off of all government-derived models, right? So our pond builder, a basin builder, we design it the same way that NRCS does. In fact, we have source code embedded in it. And so, for instance, our soil calculator and our buffer builder and our sediment tracker, we're using the same technology that USDA developed, It's just that they take 460 acres, 8 or 9 hours to run the software. We've launched it into Amazon Web Service. We've put a GIS framework around it. We can access your LiDAR data, and we do it in 2 or 3 minutes. And so I just want to assure everybody we're not out there making this stuff up. We're using the same models that are available to anybody. It's just that we've got a lead on the market, and we went out and we put the models together with the help of USDA's Agricultural Research Service.
If I can, if you have questions, we'll certainly take them. But I have one, again, here talking about the alternative practices. And I don't know if Buzzer or anybody else has come up with, if you put this 16.5-foot buffer here or 50-foot buffer here, you will save X amount of tons of soil loss. And then we have to equate that to an alternative practices that would do the same thing. Can you come up with numbers that would say, if you do this, it'll be the same as putting in a buffer?
Mr. Chair, yes, but remember they're modeled numbers, right? So all modeled numbers have some variance in them based on rainfall and stuff, but that is exactly what we're doing, is that we're taking all the rainfall data, all the soil erosion, all the soil types, erosivity, we're putting it into the model, and then we're predicting at every 10-foot segment along a stream, what's the sediment delivery through that, because that's a 3-meter-wide pixel in computer talk. And so about every 10 feet along a stream, we are evaluating how much sediment is being delivered. And then if you put in a buffer, how much reduction in sediment delivery is there? Because it's not 100%. It varies from farm to farm.
Questions, Representative South?
Just so I got it, you're running everything right now at the model level. And you have not a design, install, measure back situation yet.
Mr. Blumen, go ahead.
Yeah. So we are calibrating the model. So we are working with the Agricultural Research Service, and they have written peer-reviewed papers on the models that we're using. And so there's been in the Journal of Soil and Water Conservation and the Hydraulics Journal, like peer-reviewed papers that they've written. But I would say the testing is not as robust as it can be. So I don't know that we're getting down to the right tons, but I think that it's relative. It's very good, right? This relative here, a relative to this system, a different system would yield this much. And so I don't think we're comfortable saying this is the exact number, but I think we're pretty comfortable in saying this system compared to this system, we can compare quite adequately.
Yeah. I've been through multiple software development rollouts and everything in my life, and I know how that world works.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I heard reference that you're working with Land O'Lakes on an identified installation that you are either in the process of either approving or building out or whatever. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Mr. Blumen.
And that would be the first iteration of the system driving an actual install where then you could measure the impact.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So it's not like it's never been done before. These models exist inside of government offices, right? And they run them on their desktop, and they've modeled erosion with them, and they've modeled outputs, and they've checked them, and we're working with Iowa State University now to do more checking. So I would say that it's not the first iteration that's being done, but it's an early iteration that we're doing.
Okay. Thank you. Very good. Further questions? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say this is just an excellent presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for arranging this. It was just very well done. It's very informative and enlightening, and I think it kind of sometimes we cringe at public policy initiatives that come forward, and we might not always be fully supportive of some things, but this is a good example of how maybe public policy can drive something and private enterprise is stepping up and actually contributing to the solution. So I appreciated the opportunity to hear this today. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers.
Yeah, very good presentation. And when we visited, it just seemed like a fit that this could be used with coming up with policies and practices that would do the job in Minnesota and yet maybe not take up as much land and yet do the intended job. Question? No? Okay. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much for coming. I'd buy you lunch, but I got to go to another meeting.
Thank you,
Mr. Blumen and Becky, thank you much. And we have your numbers if we want to get some more information, okay? Thank you. And thanks, members, for hearing that. And last up on the agenda is Adam Burke, who is with the Minnesota Corn Growers. He's the executive director. And he has, I think, something related to what we just heard. So, Mr. Burr, identify yourself and go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Adam Burr. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, as well as the Minnesota Corn Research and Promotion Council. And I do have something very much related, and I want to thank you on behalf of our more than 7,000 members of the Corn Growers Association and the nearly 25,000 farmers that grow corn throughout the state to present to you two activities that I think are related, very much well dovetail in with our previous conversation, specifically alternative practices and our innovation grant program. And relative to the former, the alternative practices research, you know, we've consistently stated when the buffer law was first introduced that this was not a one-size-fits-all solution to a wicked problem like water quality. There are no easy solutions, no silver bullets when we're talking about addressing and improving water quality. And certainly buffers work in some situations, as was alluded to in the previous by the previous speaker, but there are certainly other practices that can achieve the same goals as the buffers. And I think the buffer law acknowledges this with the inclusion of the language that alternative riparian water quality practices or combinations of structural, vegetative, and management practices based on the NRCS Field Office Technical Guide or other practices approved by the board that provide water quality protection comparable to buffer protection for the water body adjacent to the property. That's the language directly in the buffer law. We've received lots of questions from our members relative to this alternative practice language that is in the law, asking us what are those alternative practices. And we took it upon ourselves to visit with the Board of Soil and Water Resources and Mr. Jasky and his staff and ask them where they were at in identifying these alternative practices. And we found that we kind of have a shared interest in identifying particularly those practices that fall outside the Field Office Technical Guide. You know, those other practices or suites of practices, understanding what is their benefit to water quality that's not, again, identified in the Field Office Technical Guide. So we approached them, asked them if they would work with us if we were to sponsor and fund a research project to look into these alternative practices, and we were very happy that they were willing to work with us on that, and we in turn approached the University of Minnesota to fund to do such a project, and are working with Dr. David Mulla in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate, and in partnership with the Board of Soil and Water Resources to identify and look at these alternative practices. Now, this project just started after the first of the year. The goal of the project is to develop a decision tree process. So we're looking for something pretty simple here that can identify the appropriate suites of alternative practices that could substitute for the buffer requirements on agricultural land where appropriate. The project has begun with a literature review that has been initiated to summarize the effectiveness of selected ag BMPs under Minnesota conditions at protecting and improving water quality adjacent to agricultural lands. The BMPs that they're initially looking at kind of fall into three categories. They're common practices that you can find throughout Minnesota. Those that avoid, these would be things like cover crops. Those that trap, so these would be your water and sediment control basins, your constructed wetlands. Or those that control, things like conservation tillage. This would be vertical tillage, strip tillage, and the like. Pollutant losses. So that's one aspect of the project that's been initiated here after the first of the year. The second part, and it was alluded to earlier in the discussion, is what is the baseline effectiveness of these vegetative strips that we're measuring against? And so Dr. Mulla and his team are going to be evaluating the 50-foot and 16.5-foot buffer in ag environments that represent a wide range of cropping system, a wide range of climatic patterns and soils and landscape characteristics that are prevalent throughout Minnesota to establish that baseline that then we'll measure these alternative suites of practices against. The data from the literature review and the modeling approach will then be used to assemble a database that quantifies the pollutant reductions of these different alternative practices for different site conditions. And then ultimately, this database will be used to inform a simple decision tree model that's available to all farmers as well as local conservation planners that can be used to identify these site-specific options of alternative water quality practices or combinations thereof with the buffer to achieve the goal of the law. The goal is to present this information, this decision tree, to the Bowser Board at their March meeting for inclusion in their policy guidance relative to the buffer law implementation. So that's the relative to the alternative practices that I wanted to touch on. The second part that I think is related is our innovation grant program. This is another effort by Minnesota Corn to identify tools that farmers can use towards improving particularly nitrogen management and reducing nitrate loss to surface or groundwater. We initiated this program back in 2016. It's sort of a small block program that offered to farmers to apply if they want to try a piece of equipment or they want to try a different practice. We were offering small block funds to them to help offset some of their costs they might have. Last year we had 18 proposals and funded 6 projects. For 2017, there was a lot of more increased interest in because of the success of the first year, and we received 34 proposals and are moving forward with 22 projects. These projects, like I said, are really focused on nitrogen management and retention and include a broad range of practices that go from cover crops, reduced tillage systems, novel nitrogen manure management practices, soil testing, looking at programs like we talked about earlier that are designed to improve nitrogen use efficiency. There's some really interesting precision agricultural tools coming out that can help really manage that nitrogen at a very fine level. The question we get from farmers is, does that technology work? And with the different options that are out there in these tools, how does one compare to the other? So we wanted to provide these grants to look at those. So these were ideas that farmers brought to us, tapping into the innovation that the farmers have, and then were in turn selected by our farmers to support for the funding. The innovation projects represent more than a $233,000 investment this year. The alternative practice research is close to a $50,000 investment of the corn checkoff. And I'll remind you that the corn checkoff is a farmer's self-imposed tax. It's freely refundable by the farmer. This is in addition to the nearly $1 million in research we're doing in active projects this year alone related to nitrogen management, largely at the University of Minnesota. All of these efforts, partnering with the University of Minnesota, partnering with the Board of Soil and Water Resources to identify alternative practices relative to the buffer law, as well as investing in innovation projects, are part of our larger vision that we launched this past fall to become the most sustainable corn farmers in the United States. So with that, I thank you for your time and be happy to take questions.
Dr. Burr, thank you. Corn Grow is really stepping up with the funding and ideas and things to push the envelope and do the right thing, so thank you for that. Further questions? Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too wanted to just say thank you for stepping up. And I think it's, again, important to acknowledge when we do see these really good things happening in our communities and within our organizations, and to have corn growers kind of do what the right thing is, and to understand that they may be part of the problem. They're certainly stepping up, and they are definitely part of the solution. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Brewer, you mentioned you'll be meeting with Bowser at their March meeting. Was that correct?
That's the goal. At the latest would be to present at their Bowser, their March board meeting, to present this decision tree for them to adopt as part of their guidance.
And I think that the timeline was for Bowser to come out with their practices in March. You think they'll make it?
The hope is that these practices will be available for those deadlines. Obviously, we would hope to come up with these practices sooner, and these researchers are moving as quickly as possible. This is a short timeline for them. We initiated the project in January. To get this project moving, it gives them about 3 months to do the research and do the work and come out with the recommendations.
Well, when you say January, this is Minnesota. Are they modeling or actually doing some in the field?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that was the idea behind this. Because of the short timeline, there's no new research with this outside of the modeling that they're going to do and then just going combing through the existing literature that's out there. Given the time constraints, it just wasn't possible to do new research beyond the modeling exercises.
Very good. Thank you very much, and thanks to the corn growers for the work you're doing in this area. Questions? Not seeing none. Thanks, Dr. Burr. And with that, the meeting